big ones, but they were like a four element and a horizontal and vertical.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. The Mark IV was a four element, vertical, horizontal. It was very impressive performance out of an antenna. A good friend of mine had a pair of co-phased Moonraker Mark IVs, which was two of them, and it was a very impressive performance out of that on 4 watts, not running any linears or anything like that, and it performed well. Unfortunately, Mother Nature decided one day that it was going to come down.
Biggest thing that I can remember seeing was somebody had a pair, they were stacked multiple element beams, and they were just monsters.
Well, you know, if you're talking 11 meters, I mean, you're talking about a significant size of an antenna. And when you start going after multiple antennas, co-phased, for an example, you had a lot of wind load. And, I mean, when it worked, it worked. But when it came down, the neighbors would not be impressed.
Well, I never had to worry about that because I never got past that having that little Jupiter's ground plane on the roof, and then when I got out of it, it went down too. So I mean, that was it. I never really got back into it.
Well, for myself, I mean, I've been absent from amateur for, probably about 15 years, and I recently got back into it, and I'm enjoying it. It's just a lovely way to get back in touch with some of the things that I love to do, but I think back to the days when, in the 70s and the 80s, playing with the 11 meters. I still have the radios from then. And it was probably some of the best times for learning, because you really had to be, if you wanted to get out, if you wanted to reach out, you really had to be on the game. And anybody that poo-poos that band, I do not agree with that, because I think about how much I learned and how much I can use today, and it was time well spent.
And I know I spend a lot of time going down to breaks and campouts down in the States. Down there, we were quite welcome to come down and play with them.
You'll find a lot of the stations south of the border find themselves on this repeater as well. There's no border when, as far as amateurs radio, or radio, never mind amateur radio, radio. There's no borders.
I remember I got involved in motorsport very seriously, and I went down to work a race down in Tacoma, and I was down there, I was going, walking around some of the stuff, and there's a bunch of the guys in the radio club down there were helping out at the race, and I thought, well, they're doing stuff in the background, I'm trackside doing my thing, and what are you doing down here? And it was a rather interesting event.
Oh boy, you're touching on one of the subjects near and dear to my heart, motorsports. I used to have a, well, probably still, but I used to have a NHRA license, and I used to go down to Kent, Washington, and for racing down there. 64 funny cars, all the different events down in Kent, SIR.
Yeah, I've been down there, but not for for drag racing, for road racing. That was where my interest laid. Like I learned my craft up at Westwood in Coquitlam, if you're familiar with that area.
Oh, very much familiar with it. I didn't spend a lot of time there because I was my first love of automotive was quarter mile. So Mission had closed down at that day, at that time. So I spent a lot of time at Kent, and my NHRA license is signed by a couple of fairly large names in that sport. I haven't been into it in a long time, but back then, you know, I was trying to go professional. It didn't happen, but I never give it up for a minute for what I learned and what I did.
What kind of car were you driving?
I had two. They were very, very similar cars. The first one was a 1968 Mercury Cougar, and the second one was a 1969 Mercury Cougar.
Now, that is a car that my friend used to have. I don't know exactly what year, but he had a Cougar. And she was very proud of it.
Well, you know, there's Fords and there's Chevys. But then you start getting into the Mercurys and the Pontiacs, right? And you start getting into a little bit more of a niche market. And that's where I found myself with the Cougar. I fully respect, you know, Mustangs and, you know, stuff like that. But I was a little bit of a rebel, and I really liked the Cougars, and I had a lot of success, but it was at that era where things started becoming very commercialized and very expensive, and I had to make a decision, and unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on the way you look at it, I made a choice, and I didn't pursue the drag racing. I guess lifestyle, and no regrets. I'm looking at my car that's sitting in my garage, a couple of feet away from me right now, and I still have fun playing with them. But
back when the Trans Am was going, Dan Gurney fielded a pair of Cougars to run in the Trans Am, and he did very well with them. They were basically a Mustang, but I believe the wheelbase was about 2 inches longer, and I don't know if that affected things, but they were basically a Mustang with an extended wheelbase and different body style.
Well, that's what actually made the Cougar very, to me anyway, made the Cougar very appealing, was the fact that it was almost a Mustang. So all the go-fast parts were the same. You're close. It wasn't 2 inches. It was 3, to be specific, inches difference. And that was between the forward mount of the light leaf spring and the axle. They were, okay, let's flash back for a moment. I had an opportunity to meet Dan Gurney some years ago, and a couple other large names in the industry. It was an era. It was something that I look back fondly upon.
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't really get involved in the Trans Am when it was in its heyday. I sort of got picked up later on, but I was too involved in the CB radio to get into the racing. It was just one thing off, pick up your time, and then you get out of one thing and you swap into something else that takes all your time.
Well, I was fortunate enough to be in that era where you could still be an independent and be somewhat productive. I got to meet a few of the big names in the industry. Parnelli Jones comes to mind, and where I grew up, the owner of the 1969 Mustang Boss 302 that won the Can-Am owned the car, and I got to know him, and through that I got to know some of the people that were involved with that. It was one of those things that was right place, right time. I don't know what else to say there. I feel fortunate to be in that time and era.
Yeah, I followed it. I originally got my interest in racing with, would you believe, racing slot cars. And through that, that's how I got interested in the real road race cars. And that just took over. It's just being trackside, when you get a field of about 30 or 40 cars going by, it's just it's an adrenaline rush.
It's amazing how small that world is. It really is. To put that in perspective, I had a 1968 Cougar XR7, which was a significant performance vehicle, and it was producing some pretty good numbers back in the day. But I got into a car accident with that car, and I broke the shifter. It was a pretty usual Hurst Competition Plus shifter, but I broke it in the accident. And the thing was, I had borrowed it from the guy that owned the 1969 Boss 302 that had won the 1969 Trans Am Circuit, and I broke it with my ribs. to be accurate, and I don't know where I'm going with this conversation, but I really enjoyed that era, and I miss it a lot today. I really do, because the commercial perspective to that today compared to back then, you can't be an independent anymore. You have to be sponsored. You have to be in the fold, I guess, is the way to put it.
Yeah, the commercialism and the cost just to for the equipment, and then all the support equipment. let alone the entry fees and everything else is just, yeah, I mean, it was bad enough when you were going down to volunteer to work at the races, but the amount of money that these guys put out, and now that all they got the big haulers and all the commercial, you know, the stuff that they're selling to help make up, you know, help bring money into the team.
Well, I mean,